through the Denver chapter and the Des Moines chapter of the American Indian Movement to order all AIM members throughout the United States who are available to converge on Wounded Knee armed.
Wounded Knee, South Dakota, located on the Pine Ridge Reservation. This is where nearly 300 Lakota men, women, and children were massacred by the United States Army on December 29, 1890. 8 decades later, the Oglala Lakota would return to reclaim it.
They seized their hostages last night in a swift raid on the town.
On February 27, 1973, 300 members of the American Indian Movement and Lakota of Pine Ridge Reservation occupy the town and assert their sovereignty.
Today, the community is encircled by hundreds of policemen and several armored personnel carriers. The Indians, police say, have enough supplies to hold out for weeks.
It was an important moment for the American Indian Movement. The grassroots group formed in 1968 to address poverty, discrimination, and police brutality against indigenous peoples. Then, after failing to impeach tribal president Dick Wilson over accusations of corruption, the Pine Ridge people asked for AIM's help. Protesters also criticized the United States government for failing to honor the treaties.
Well, we're trying to do is to force the white man to live up to his own existing laws.
The occupation lasted 71 days.
I learned a great deal from a director named Ingmar Bergman.
Meanwhile, 1,000 miles away in a different world from the reservation, Hollywood's elite were getting ready for the biggest night of the year, the Academy Awards.
I think we should say that those nominated for the best performance by an actor are
Marlon Brando.
Marlon Brando was favored to win Best Actor for his role in The Godfather. It had been a month since the Lakota took over Wounded Knee.
The winner is
on March 27, 1973, Apache actress and model Sasheen Littlefeather took the Oscar stage.
Accepting the award for Marlon Brando and The Godfather, Miss Sasheen Littlefeather.
Hello, my name is Sasheen Littlefeather. I'm Apache, and I'm president of the National Native American Affirmative Image Committee.
Danse Anin Buju. Hello and welcome. This is Unreserved on CBC Radio 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. What happened that night in 1973 is famous, or infamous, depending on who you talk to. Some audience members booed at the woman dressed in the northern traditional buckskin dress. Others applauded and cheered. John Wayne was so angry he had to be restrained from attacking her. One thing is for sure, the blowback cost Littlefeather her acting career, but it never dulled her shine. Now, 50 years later, the Academy has offered an official apology to the Apache actor, model, radio director, activist, and healer. Today on Radio Indigenous, we welcome Sasheen Littlefeather. Hello, Sasheen. Welcome to Unreserved.
Hi. I'm very glad to be here with everyone.
I'm so pleased to welcome you on the show. You are iconic. You are fierce, and your story is an amazing journey that we are looking forward to sharing with people. Let's go back to that moment in time 50 years ago. Take us back to that first phone call with Marlon Brando. Did he call you, or did you call him? How did this idea to take over the Oscar stage happen?
I did not call Marlon Brando. I don't think anybody can reach Marlon Brando. He is a very reclusive individual. I wrote him a letter a year before, and Francis Ford Coppola, who was a neighbor of mine where I lived in San Francisco, gave me his address, and I wrote him a very sincere letter asking Marlon Brando if he was really sincerely interested in Native American Indian people and causes thereof. or if he was just interested in Native people because he was going to play the role of an Indian in a film. And I also expressed my interest in the stereotype of Native American Indian people in television, in film, and in the sports industry. And I said, if you are interested in those things, please do not hesitate to give me a call.
And when he reached out to you, what did he tell you? What did he say to you?
I was working at KFRC Radio, the Big 610, which is the biggest rock and roll station in San Francisco. And I hadn't heard anything from Marlon Brando for more than a year. Mm. Well, you would think at that point that a person would give up. But somehow I knew inside of myself, I'll hear from him one of these days. Well, one of these days happened. And at the radio station, just about quitting time, the phone rang and the operator came on and said, there's a mysterious man on the phone that will not give his name, but he wants to speak with you. So I picked up the phone and this voice came on and said, I bet you don't know who this is. And I said, sure I do. He said, well, who is it? And I said, this is Marlon Brando. And I said, it sure as hell took you a long time to call. And we started laughing and laughing and laughing. And then we just started talking and yakking like two old friends, like two old crows in a gab fest. And we had a lot in common. And we had about an hour's conversation. And then I said I had to get out of the office because the janitors were coming in and I had to leave. So I gave them my home number. So then thereafter, he called me at home. And we continued with our conversations then. But it wasn't about film. And it wasn't about the industry, per se. It was just about our interests together in the Native American stereotype. And at that time, I was going to meetings with the Federal Communications Commission with a group of other people of color to make reports about stereotypes of Native Americans, and the others were making reports on their stereotypes about their ethnic group to the FCC and what was being served, if you will, to our children who were being miseducated about who we really are. Mm-hmm. And we were kind of the first of our kind, if you will, back in that day, which was in 1972, way back then. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the new year came and it was 73, and I continued with my work. And I never thought anything about it. I never talked to anybody about the fact that I was talking to Marlon Brando. I kept that pretty well hidden. And then the time came when he called me the weekend of the Academy Awards. And then he asked me on a Saturday if I would represent him at the Academy Awards. And I told him, when is it? It seemed like a reasonable question to
me. Absolutely.
And he said, it's Monday night. At that time, it used to be on Monday evening at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, which is where it was always held back then. And if you travel back into your time machine, the Academy Award was the only show in town. And it was a really, really, really big show.
Yeah.
All the major movie stars from all over the world used to walk down that red carpet. And everybody was glued to their television sets. Now, this was the first time in television history that this 1973 Academy Award was broadcast via satellite around the world. So it was different than any other Academy Award that had ever been shown before. So when Marlon asked me to do this for him, he told me it might make a big difference in my life.
Kind of an understatement.
Of course, I was naive to these facts because I had never been in the public spotlight to that degree before. And he warned me that I might be lied about, and he talked to me about it. And I was only a young person of 26 years old. I had just turned 26 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, if it was going to help Native American Indian people, yes, I would do anything.
Mm.
And I was very sincere about this, and I still am. And so I said yes. And then he asked me, what did I have to wear? And I said, well, I don't have any evening clothes. The only thing I wear is a pair of Levi's and a top. And he told me, well, you can't wear that. So he said, don't you have anything else? And I said, well, the only other thing I have that's at all formal is my Northern traditional Indian buckskin dress and my moccasins and hair ties. And he said, okay. So in a way, you could say that he chose my outfit for me.
It was a powerful moment when you walked up on that stage dressed in your buckskin dress and your hair ties and this, the words you spoke with such a surety, with such certainty, with such calmness. Why did you agree to do it? Knowing that there was 85 million people watching around the world, knowing that all these celebrities were going to be there, knowing that you might get attacked, you might get lied about.
Number one, I knew that if you speak the truth will last beyond the time of eternity. The truth will always be your friend and your advocate. And just because people cannot accept the truth is their problem and not your problem. Number one, let's be perfectly clear about that. And I was willing to do this because I knew that my ancestors were behind me, before me, and surrounding me. That evening was not without prayer.
Hmm.
Prayer is the number one substance of my life. There is not a morning in my life that does not begin with prayer since I was a very young child. That is the manna that I go to because I have always given thanks for what I have, however much I have or forever little I have. I've always given thanks to the Creator because I think it's absolutely essential. I'm not a wealthy person at all. I don't have a lot. But for what I have, I'm very, very grateful. And that includes my health. That includes the ability to speak before people. So with all of this in mind, I said, yes, I will do this, to get up there and to represent all of those people who cannot speak. And I'm going to tell the truth once and for all. But you need to know that Marlon Brando works in a certain way, his own way. It's like Frank Sinatra's song, I'll do it my way. Well, Marlon did not have that speech together until about an hour before I left for the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion that night. And that was well after that show had begun, the Oscar show. So his nephew, who was there at his home that night, practicing guitar with a friend of his, and Marlon's secretary, who had hurriedly typed up on approximately 6 to 8 pages his speech, gave me that hurried speech. And the only chance I had to read it was by flashlight in the car on the way over. And the two kids, if you will, had driven the secretary's Cadillac to the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, and they were dressed in a t-shirt and shorts. And his secretary and I were, she was dressed in an evening gown, and I was dressed in my buckskin dress. So we were like the odd couple.
Mm-hmm.
And she had the tickets for the evening for the Academy Awards. And you talk about Indian time. We got there about 20 minutes before that program was due to end at 9 o'clock. So again, we were just there on the skirts of the end of that program. So the security men were there at the gate and wanted to know, who are these two?
Mm.
Well, his secretary explained who we were and showed the tickets. So they had to call the producer of the whole program, Howard Koch, and tell him, look, we have a situation here. And we were the situation.
Yeah. Indeed.
And so we had the two tickets that were Marlon Brando's tickets to sit in the first two rows. And he was a candidate for the Academy Award. And as far as they knew up to that time, he had been a no-show. So Howard Koch agreed, okay, what's that in your hand? And I said, it's the acceptance speech, should Marlon Brando win? And he said, oh no, he said, you're not going to read that. If you read that, I will cut you off. You hear me? And I said, yes. So he said, I will give you 60 seconds or less. And if you go over 60 seconds, he said, I will have you arrested. I will have you put in handcuffs. I will have you put in jail. And he pointed to the police officers there who would do exactly that. Now, I had made Marlon Brando a promise that I would not touch that Academy Award. So those are two promises right there. I would not go over 60 seconds, or I would be arrested, handcuffed, and put in jail. I had made the second promise to Marlon that I would not touch that statuette, that Oscar. Those I had to keep. So with that, I was escorted down the aisle with Marlon's secretary to the first two rows where all the candidates for the Academy Awards sat. And I sat in Marlon Brando's chair and took his place that night. Now, that's a pretty tense place to be, I can tell you for a fact. But when Marlon's name was announced for the Academy Award, I had to get up and make the stairway up. And I had to make sure that I didn't trip on the fringes of my northern buckskin dress. And that was a feat within itself. I didn't want to cause a scene and fall flat on my face.
Mm.
So as gracefully as I could, I made my way up the stairway to the main platform and one of my favorite actresses in the whole wide world, Liv Ullmann, started to outstretch the Academy Award to me. And I had to hold my hand up like this, because I had promised Marlon not to touch that Oscar.
Hello, my name is Sasheen Littlefeather. I'm Apache, and I'm president of the National Native American Affirmative Image Committee. I'm representing Marlon Brando this evening, and he has asked me to tell you in a very long speech, which I cannot share with you presently because of time, but I will be glad to share with the press afterwards, that he very regretfully cannot accept this very generous award. And the reasons for this being are the treatment of American Indians today by the film industry. Excuse me. And on television, in movie reruns, and also with recent happenings at Wounded Knee. I beg at this time that I have not intruded upon this evening, and that we will, in the future, our hearts and our understandings will meet with love and generosity. Thank you on behalf of Marlon Brando.
I made that speech on my behalf, putting in Wounded Knee, and I mentioned the stereotype as best I could in those 60 seconds. And I heard those boos coming towards me, but I was like Teflon.
Mm-hmm.
I just sent them right back, and I wish them well. Forgive them, for they know not what they do.
Mm-hmm.
When I was up there speaking at that platform, Rosanna, there was a big noise that was happening backstage behind me. And it was John Wayne, who was very upset at what I was saying up at the platform in my refusal of that Oscar, and about what I was saying about Native American Indian people. And he came at me from behind the stage to assault me physically. And he had to be restrained by six security men in order to keep him from doing so. John Wayne was never removed from the Academy for that act, never received any discipline action for that act whatsoever. And it was hidden more or less from the press and kept from the public.
Mm.
But that is exactly what happened.
You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. That is an incredible scene that you have just described for us, Sasheen. Thank you so much for that. We're going to take that Oscar moment and just put it aside for now, because you were also an activist and you were involved in the media and you did all of this behind-the-scenes work for the Indigenous rights movement. How did you get involved in Wounded Knee?
I'm interested in everything Native, as most Native American Indian people are. I supported Wounded Knee as much as I could from where I was, by keeping abreast of the information, you know, and by talking to other Native Americans, how we could raise money for, you know, the occupation and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And then with Marlon, he was a big supporter of Wounded Knee, and he and I spoke about it often. And I knew he wanted to do something about it, and he felt that mentioning it at the Academy Awards was something that he could do to play it out on the worldwide stage. Now, the press after couldn't wait to go to Wounded Knee. So they came from all over the place and put the spotlight on Wounded Knee. I learned from Dennis Banks, Russell Means, and Orrin Lyons, who were at Wounded Knee, that they were surrounded around the television because they had gotten a personal call from Marlon Brando, who told them to watch the Academy Awards that night, which they did on this little television set with this screen, this, and you know, black and white screen where they were holed up. And when I came on at the Academy Awards and made that 60-second speech and mentioned Wounded Knee, that they all were jubilant and started yelling and cheering and so forth, like they had just won a football game, you know, a major league football game. And some of them took their guns outside and started firing their guns. And Russell told me, oh, he said, you don't know what a celebration it was for us, how much it meant for us. And of course, Russell Means was like my brother, and I was like his little sister. We always had that relationship.
A few years earlier, before Wounded Knee, you were also at Alcatraz, and that occupation was also organized by AIM. After the prison closed, Indigenous peoples wanted that island returned to them, and they had plans of creating a cultural center and school on the island. And you were in college then, Sasheen. How did you go from college student to Alcatraz Island occupier?
Well, the facts were that there were 14 college students. I was not among them. Mm-hmm. And they were the original occupants of Alcatraz Island, which lasted for 18 months, to be exact. And one of the leaders was a college student at San Francisco State University, Richard Oakes, who was a Mohawk Indian from Akwesasne, back on the East Coast. And Richard was very charismatic, a mighty figure in the community. And it was known as the United Indians of All Tribes.
Yes.
And it was the All Red Nations, is what we used to call ourselves. Now, I, being a college student, I had to study and take examinations and be in class. I had only gone to school by virtue of grants and scholarship. In order to maintain that, I had to take my studies seriously. I couldn't go off on this cause, that cause, and the other cause. Mm. So I only got to go on Alcatraz as a weekend warrior, so to speak. So myself and some other college students would go on the weekend, and we were kind of quiet because I was an urban Indian raised as a white person. And of course, I, like other urban Indians, had been discriminated against and so on and so forth. We have our own tales to tell. But we're not reservation Indian. And so we got to meet all other Native people there on the island. Reservation Indian, urban Indian, traditional Native Americans from the Hopi Indian Reservation in Arizona, for example. And we got to connect with our own Indianness there on the island, Indians of all tribes. And it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. And it sparked in us what we could do and how we could use our talents to further Native causes, to further and use our talents to help our own people. For me, it was through the media. It's not being on the island, I don't believe. That was the important thing. For me, it's what did you do since you were on the island with mm-hmm. your life? I went ahead and helped to support and being one of the creative people for the Song for Dead Warrior, for example, for a ballet with the San Francisco Ballet Company, myself and Jasper Redrow, who is Northern Cheyenne from Montana, we became the creative consultants for that ballet that traveled around the world and won an Emmy Award for Best Performances Dance in America on PBS. It was a story of the urban Indian, of the Indian person who came on relocation to the urban Indian area. And it was patterned after the life of Richard Oakes, who had since died for the cause, who of course was Mohawk from Akwesasne. And it was a beautiful rendition for its time. So those are just one of the things that I did that was sparked that creativity since Alcatraz Island.
Yeah. And when you talk about that spark, and even though you were a weekend warrior at Alcatraz and as an urban Indian going there and meeting other Indigenous nations from all across, you know, Turtle Island, what was it about Alcatraz that sparked that in you, that desire to learn more about your culture and who you are?
Well, first of all, Native American Indian programs at the university were starting. And Dave Risling, who was a Hoopa Indian from Northern California, he started with Dr. Jack Forbes, who was also Native. They taught at UC Davis, University of California at Davis. They began a Native American Studies program. And because Dave Risling was on the island of Alcatraz, and so was Jack Forbes, I believe that they started the program because of Alcatraz and started it for the younger people. There were lots of classes that began in Native studies, and I availed myself of that because, you know, I was relegated to taking American history, American literature, and studying all the dominant society history. And now it was an opportunity to learn my own history, which was pretty much before that, you know, forbidden. I didn't know much about it because it wasn't taught in the schools. After all, I was born right after World War II in 1946. And I had, at that time, had experience drinking out of the black drinking faucets, going and having to go to the black bathrooms, could not drink out of the white drinking faucets, could not go to the white bathrooms. When you couldn't enter a cafe because you were not the right color, when the signs were up, no dogs or Indians allowed, there was a sign on the door. When I went back to the reservation for a visit when I was a young girl, I went to a gas station to ask directions. And so I got out of the pickup truck and went to the front door of this little cafe in the country, and had a gas station there in this cafe. And suddenly the door slammed in my face and the sign came up closed. And there were white people all in there, you know, eating in the little cafe. So I turned around and I walked back to my mother, who was white, in the pickup truck. And I heard this woman screaming and yell at me, "Get out of here. you don't belong here. And she picked up rocks and started throwing them at me and hitting me from behind. And I walked with dignity toward the truck and started running, and tears were coming down my eyes as I felt those rocks hitting me with every ugly word that she had said to me. Get out of here, you don't belong. And when I got in that pickup truck, I was crying, and my mother was crying because she felt my pain.
You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. Today, we are getting to know Sasheen Littlefeather. She's famous for turning down an Academy Award on behalf of Marlon Brando in 1973, but there is so much more to her amazing journey. Sasheen, thank you so much for being vulnerable with us today and sharing that moment.
Thank you. You don't know a person until you know the road they've traveled, until you know where they've been. And where they have been might not be that place that is ideal, but you can always take a situation and turn it around to a place of understanding and forgiveness. Mm-hmm.
I think this is a good moment to play a little music. So what does Sasheen Littlefeather listen to when she wants to get fired up or inspired or calmed down or revved up?
I love the music from the 60s. And I'm always singing. I can't sing, but I sing anyway.
Same.
I do my sing-alongs to crazy songs like, "This diamond ring doesn't ring for me anytime." And I love Dionne Warwick. I sing a little prayer for you. Holy cow. Forever, you stay in my heart, and I will love you forever and ever. We never were part of how I'll love you together. Together, that's how it must be to live with that you would only mean heartbreak for me. And I also love Native American Indian music, both Northern and Southern style singing. And when I play music that's Indian style, I just rev it up and start dancing. And I just love it. Oh, I have to say, salsa music.
You sure are eclectic. Got lots of music in there.
Love salsa music. Marlon Brando. Marlon and I had that in common. He used to have the conga drums in his room, and he used to play conga drums all the time.
If you had the Academy Awards night to do over again, would you do any of that differently?
Well, I don't think so, no. I felt that that there was an opportunity for, since the American Indian hasn't been able to hear his voice heard, or have his voice heard anywhere in the history of the United States, I felt that it was a marvelous opportunity for an Indian to be able to voice his opinion to 85 million people. I guess that was the number. And I felt that he had a right to, in view of what Hollywood has done to him. And I was embarrassed for Shasheen. She wasn't able to say what she intended to say. And I was distressed that people should have booed and whistled and stomped, even though perhaps it was directed at myself. They should have at least had the courtesy to listen to her. But I think she did very well, and I was very glad that she did have what opportunity she had to say what she did. And
why didn't you get to read your entire statement as you planned it?
Well, I think that they felt that it was inappropriate. And I actually don't know. I think they didn't want her there. They didn't want the evening interrupted with that particular note. And from their insular point of view, I felt that perhaps they had a point. But I don't think that people generally realize what the motion picture industry has done to the American Indian. As a matter of fact, all ethnic groups, all minorities, all non-whites. And people just simply don't realize. They just took it for granted that that's the way people are going to be presented, and these cliches were just going to be perpetuated.
Of course, that's Marlon Brando speaking with Dick Cavett on The Dick Cavett Show in 1973. The things that he was saying in that Dick Cavett interview were really interesting to me. I mean, he seemed very forward-thinking, because this is, as a reminder to our audience, was 50 years ago. People weren't having these conversations about stereotypes and tropes and, you know, the harm that it caused to, you know, Indigenous children and children of color. What did you think about, you know, celebrities like Marlon, like Jane Fonda, like all of those people in that era getting involved in Indigenous, you know, rights fights? Was it helpful?
I think yes. I think that Marlon was way ahead of his time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was way ahead of my time.
You're listening to Unreserved on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, and Native Voice 1. I'm Rosanna Deerchild. My guest today is Shasheen Littlefeather, who last month received an official apology from the Academy Awards.
It's signed by David Rubin, who's the president of the Academy Awards Museum. And if you like, I can read or paraphrase it to you.
Sure, that would be great.
Okay. It is written June 18, 2022. Dear Shasheen Littlefeather, I write to you today a letter that has been a long time coming. On behalf of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, with humble acknowledgement of your experience at the 45th Academy Awards. As you stood on the Oscar stage in 1973 in recognition of the misrepresentation and mistreatment of Native American Indian people by the film industry, you made a powerful statement that continues to remind us of the necessity of respect and the importance of human dignity. The abuse you endured because of this statement was unwarranted and unjustified. The emotional burden you have lived with, through, and the cost to your own career in our industry, irreparable. For too long, the courage you showed has been unacknowledged. For this, we offer both our deepest apologies and our sincere admiration.
Wow. What's it like to read those words after 50 years, Sashin?
Unbelievable.
To say the least.
When it was read to me, towards the end, I broke down in tears. I never thought in my lifetime that I would ever receive a letter like this.
Mm-hmm. I read in the media that you had said after receiving this apology that it's only been 50 years. We have to keep our sense of humor about these things. Did you say that?
Yes, I did. I said, we Indian people are a very patient race of people. After all, it's only been 50 years.
What did you mean by that? Why keeping our sense of humor?
Well, you know, our sense of humor is our way of survival. We have to have a sense of humor. You never get anywhere without it, and I never travel anywhere without a good sense of humor. And we know we're always joking with one another. And every time you get together with another group of Native Americans, all you do is hear us laugh with one another. And it's always fun to chime in. And our conversations are always hilarious. You know, I've learned to laugh at myself a lot, in particular, not at others, but with others.
Absolutely.
And I think that's the way that we are.
Yeah. We are like that. We're joyful people. We like to share our laughter and tease people. That's how you know we love you.
Yeah.
If we're really polite to you, you should look out.
Yeah. That is for sure.
Yeah. And now, 50 years later, Sashin, what do you think of Indigenous representation on TV, in film, on stages? Do you think that it's changed?
Oh, yes. I mean, I watch Indian Country Today as often as I can, you know, and other, as much Indian news as I can get. I also enjoy Reservation Dogs.
I love that program.
We just had a friend of ours, Theda Newbress, who was on last week, and we just laughed hysterically at her part on the show. I mean, there's a lot of swearing in that program. I don't remember ever being brought up that way, myself personally, but I guess it's what goes on these days. But anyway, I also like Rutherford Falls, and Prey is a new movie. I think that's good. There's also Indian Market here in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
They just had their 100th anniversary.
Exactly.
You were part of that movement to change representation, to make it more real, to make sure Indian people were playing Indian people. Do you feel like your work is done, or is there more to do?
Oh, I always feel that there's more to do. I always feel there's so much bright talent. I mean, after all, Arizona State University in Phoenix at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism is producing so many bright Indian people to go into that field as news people. I originally wanted to be a news reporter, to tell you the truth. And of course, when I got boycotted from everything, there wasn't a chance of that, because the FBI had gone to all over Hollywood and said to people, if you hire her, like for a film, we will shut your production down. And the same thing with the talk shows. If you let her on your talk show, we will shut your production down. So people everywhere could talk all about me, but they could not let me on their show and would not.
Mm. How are you so compassionate and forgiving, considering that the blowback to that Oscar moment, and it was 60 seconds?
Because it only hurts me. It doesn't hurt anybody else. When you hold grudges against people, it hurts you. When you're angry against people, it hurts you. It doesn't hurt anybody else. But when you carry that kind of poison inside of you, you poison yourself. Don't fool anybody. When you let go, you are free. You are free as a bird to fly anywhere you want to go and to stay in that state of freedom, to be able to love, to be able to forgive, to be able to have gratitude for everything. You are free.
Now, looking back at that moment, 50 years, your incredible life, all the things that you have survived and thrived through, if you could send a message to that, you know, to that Sasheen, that 25-year-old 50 years ago, what would you say to her?
Oh, I think I would say, keep up your courage, keep being truthful, and keep one foot in front of the other, and walk tall and walk proud.
Would you still get on that stage?
Absolutely. Without a doubt.
You've been listening to an exclusive conversation with Sasheen Littlefeather on Unreserved. On September 17th, Sasheen will help guide an event put on by the Academy Awards Museum, an evening of reconciliation. The theater, which seats about 1,000 people, was sold out in less than 2 hours. I think that's better than U2 and the Beatles, perhaps. I could just be making that up, though. To set the mood, the evening's procession will be set to the theme song from The Godfather. And by request from Sasheen herself, the recessional song for the evening, a tribute to John Wayne, as everyone heads for the door.
The program begins at 5 o'clock and ends at 6:30. And as everyone exits the David Geffen Theater, there will be, over the intercom, will be playing the song called John Wayne's Tea.
I love it. Was that your personal choice, Sasheen?
We want to pay respects to John Wayne. He is not forgotten.
And there's that sense of humor that you're famous for.
Absolutely.
John Wayne's tea, John Wayne's tea. Are they plastic or are they steel? Ha ha, hey, hey, oh, hey, 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 oh, hey, oh, hey, oh.
That's all our time on Radio Indigenous. This episode was produced by Kim Kasher, Aaron Knoll, Laura Bone-Steubing, Shiloh Fagan, and me, Rosanna Deerchild. Find more on our website at cbc.ca/unreserved. Download the podcast on the CBC Listen app or your favorite places to get pods. I'm your favorite cousin, coming at you from Winnipeg in Treaty 1 territory. Kanaskunamit Nawi, Egose.
Are they plastic or are they steel? Ha ha, hey, hey, oh, hey.